Okay, I just want to begin by making a brief comment about something that's come up. I've gotten a number of emails from students in the class about the take home, and people kind of want to have a little guidance about how to write the take home. Can you look over my outline? Could you read a first draft? That sort of thing. I have to say no to all these cases, and it's not because I don't want to help, but that sort of help is it just can't be for three reasons. One reason is it's an exam, you know? You don't come up to the instructor in the middle of the exam and say, here's my answers. Could you look them over before I turn in my blue book? No one does that. And the big part of the reason why that can't be done is that it's not fair to the great bulk of the students who don't ask for that sort of help. You know, you can't just help, a handful of students, and then everyone else in the class doesn't have that option. So they can't be. And then the third reason is the main reason is the pedagogical reason. The whole idea of that take home is to challenge you to do your own thinking. You know, so you don't want to be spoon fed. You want to have that challenge so you can rise to it and figure out for yourself, you know, what's to be taken away from a course of this sort. You know, what you yourself are taking away from this. So for all those reasons, when people ask me these questions, I basically say no. I basically say you have the prompt. You know, if you do what the prompt calls for, you answer the questions directly and so on, then you'll be fine. All right. So, but and beyond that, I don't say anything. No point in emailing me the questions like that. That's the kind of answer you're going to get. Anyway, the lecture today is the climax of the whole story of the Cold War. It's the climax of the whole second half of the course. This great crisis that had been building up, it's coming to a head during this period, 1961-62. Just to put this in the context of how this part of the course has been structured and the general framing of the course, we're trying to understand both what the Cold War is about and why it was that a stable political system didn't come into being during at any point in the early Cold War period until 1963. Now, this business of the three run-ups, the three false dawns, and then the kind of one true dawn, which is the 1963 dawn. And the last time we dealt with this issue was in the context of the 1954 system, the system that seemed to be ushered in by the Paris Accords, the NATO system, a system based on the constraint of German power, the fact that the Federal Republic of Germany would be contained within this NATO structure, a structure dominated by American power, a system in which Western Europe would be given security because of the American military presence. It's an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe, but without threatening the Soviets, because as long as it was the Americans who were kind of calling the shots in the West, the Soviets didn't really have anything to worry about, because the United States, Britain, France as well, they're essentially conservative countries. They're willing to live with the status quo. Not so Germany. Germany is essentially a revisionist country because Germany is divided, half of Germany is under communist rule, and so on. If the Germans become too strong, well, that's a source of concern for the Soviets for obvious reasons. But if German power is contained, well, it's a source of reassurance to them. So you're providing security for the West, and also you're providing security for the East. That's why a system of that sort, one would think, would be relatively stable. And so then our question was, so what happened? And we know that something must have happened, because the world moves into this second great period of crisis starting in November of 1958 with the the Khrushchev-Berlin ultimatum. And it's a crisis that lasts for four whole years with various ups and downs until it comes to head with the Cuban Missile Crisis in October of 1962. So what happened? And the analysis was the effect of Soviets would have gone along with it, the Germans would have gone along with it. The sticking point had to do with American policy, the Eisenhower policy. Eisenhower didn't want to play that role. The Europeans should come together. They should provide for their own defense. America should withdraw. How could the Europeans stand up by themselves to a great nuclear power like the Soviet Union while being armed with nuclear weapons? So the Eisenhower policy implied the nuclearization of Western Europe, not just Britain and France, but Germany as well. Eisenhower made it quite clear that he was not opposed to this. And when people in his administration said, you know, isn't Germany a problem? You really want Germany to have nuclear weapons? You know, Eisenhower's reaction was, well, in the past, German strength was a problem, but that was only because Russia was weak. Now that Russia is strong, I'll take a strong Germany. Right? So that's the Eisenhower philosophy, and you see how it's implemented at the operational level in the nuclear sharing policy. Because by the end of the Eisenhower period, the year 1960, the Europeans have effective control of thousands of American nuclear weapons. Right? The American custody arrangements are purely nominal, purely token, and designed to be nominal, so that the Europeans would have the assurance that if push came to shove, they would be able to control those sorts of forces. That's the Eisenhower policy. You could understand why the Soviets would react to it the way they did. The Soviets are very aware of what's going on in the West. Okay? That's the taproot of the Great Berlin Crisis. Not a policy that's implemented in a particularly skillful way by the Soviet leadership. You realize that Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, he's semi-literate. I mean, he knows how to read, but he doesn't really even know how to write. This is not someone who had been nurtured in the great traditions of balance of power, diplomacy, and so on. It's a very amateurish way of conducting policy. Anyway, so you can understand what the taproot of the crisis was. Not that the Soviets would ever want to push it to the point of war, but they want to kind of keep giving the pot a little stir from time to time and force the West to take their concerns seriously. Very similar to the Berlin blockade, 48-49. Berlin, it's such a tempting source of leverage for the Soviets. Very easy to put pressure on the West at its most vulnerable point, especially in an issue relating to Germany. 1961, there's this total transformation of American policy when Kennedy comes to power and replaces Eisenhower, January of 1961. How did policy change? Well, on this whole issue of America's role in Europe, Eisenhower had hoped to pull out of Europe. He hoped the Europeans would come together in a kind of United States of Europe, and that great power mass in Western Europe could effectively balance the Soviets by themselves. For Kennedy, this whole notion of federal Europe, a United States of Europe, a true pooling of sovereignty, European integration, all that sort of thing. Yeah, it's nice, but it's not going to happen. Very pragmatic, very realistic, not idealistic the way Eisenhower was. You know, this is pie in the sky. We have to think in much more practical terms of what's possible. Europeans aren't going to come together. If they're going to have nuclear weapons, those weapons are going to be under national control. And in particular, the Germans are going to have to be armed with nuclear weapons. And there's this visceral dislike for the idea of a nuclear-armed Germany, in part because a nuclear-armed Germany would be able to pursue a revisionist policy in Europe, threaten war, basically. Yeah, this is scary. Americans don't like this idea. It's a basic assumption of the Kennedy policy No nuclear weapons for Germany. Okay? What this means, however, is that if the Europeans aren't going to be able to defend themselves, in particular the Germans can't defend themselves if they're not going to be allowed to have nuclear weapons, then America can't pull out of Europe. There has to be some counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. If the Europeans can't provide it for themselves, it's the Americans who have to provide it. Okay? We can't pull out of Europe. Right? We're stuck in Europe. We're trapped there. We're there not because we like the whole idea of throwing our weight around and having an American empire in the world and, you know, that kind of thing. It's like we don't have any choice. Right? There's no purely European solution to the European security problem. Once you rule out the notion of a German nuclear force, which you have to do because, well, for one thing, your NATO allies don't like it. Another thing is Soviets might go to war if the Germans move in that direction. No, it's like we have to stay. And then the notion is, but as long as we're stuck there, oh, we can't be purely passive. And as a matter of fact, we have the right to kind of call the shots, the West as a whole. I mean, McGeorge Bundy, who was Kennedy's national security advisor, you know, one of the two or three most important people in the making of policy, foreign policy, national security policy during the Kennedy period, he said very explicitly, you know, we have to pay the price of leadership. We may as well get the benefits from it. Right? We're stuck. But the fact that what we're stuck there means is that we can't stand apart from any process that might lead to war in Europe. You know, we have to have some real input into the political process that will determine whether you have war or peace. We can't just allow the Europeans to call the shots and give them some sort of American guarantee that will support them no matter what. We have to have some control over that process, a process that could lead to war and thus to the destruction of our own country, right? So the notion is America has to be far more assertive. It can't just accept these vetoes from the European allies. You know, we have to move in a much more active way to the establishment of a stable system in Europe. And what does stability mean? Well, it means that we can give the Soviets what they really need, what they really have a right to, if their main concern is their security. And in exchange for that, they should do the same thing for us, respect our most basic interests. Two very great powers relating to each other in terms of their own power, on a business-like basis, thinking in terms of their interests, putting ideology aside. That's the kind of Kennedy philosophy. And when he meets Khrushchev in Vienna in June of 1961, he basically lays out American thinking along those lines. Okay? The basic idea is we understand your security concerns. We understand your special interests in Eastern Europe. In other words, we accept Eastern Europe as a Soviet sphere of influence. We understand your concerns about Germany and about German power. In other words, we'll do what we have to do to keep Germany non-nuclear. That's your number one concern. We'll accommodate it. But in exchange for that, we want you to respect the status quo as well. You to respect Western Europe as free of your control. We want you also to recognize our interest in Berlin. We want you to kind of lay off Berlin, right? That's the deal. That's the deal that's on the table, okay? And this is something that is tantamount to a dramatic change in the American position and also in terms of America's relations with the Allies, because this is anathema to the Germans. Americans accepting the status quo, and in particular accepting the status quo in Germany, the division of Germany, the East German regime, and so on. Accepting a non-nuclear status in this way. And to a certain extent, the Germans are supported by the French, especially in 1962 reasons that I'll discuss later. The Europeans can stand up against the Americans. I'll tell you a little bit about the French. French thing now. The French are not fundamentally opposed to what the Americans are trying to do. The French do not want a nuclear-armed Germany. They're very happy with the division of Germany. But their objection is that the Americans are giving away too much too fast. That in dealing with the Soviets, you need a certain element of toughness. And the kind of arrangements the Americans want, well, they can emerge at the end of a negotiation. But you don't want to give the stuff away at the beginning because you're giving the other side the false impression that you're scared to death, that you're running away from nuclear deterrence, that you're afraid of war, and that you'll give the other side whatever the other side wants as long as the other side screams loud enough. French say, no, that's not the way to deal with them. If you do that, if you proceed in that fashion, you're not just going to lose Berlin. You're going to lose all of West Germany. West Germany is going to be alienated from you, lose confidence in you, turn to neutralism, and so on. And that would be a disaster for France. It's important once NATO system collapses and de Gaulle sees the Americans running away from nuclear deterrence. He sees the Americans prepared to kind of give everything away. He says in 1961, private, we are at the hour of Munich. The Americans will never run a serious risk of nuclear war in which their own cities are at risk for the sake of Europe. When the NATO system collapses, there has to be something else in place that's viable. And it's like, you don't want Germany to turn to nationalism. That creates all kinds of problems. You don't want Germany to turn to neutralism. A power vacuum in the heart of Europe is it would be terrible for France. The Soviets would fall. Instead, you want to lay the basis for some sort of West European entity that could defend itself and replace the NATO system. This is like a safety net. Right? So the Gaulle strategy is the strategy of the safety net. And so there should be something else in place. And in order to provide the basis for the construction of such a system, you have to show some elements of solidarity with the Germans and join with them in opposing this American policy of just laying down the law to the Europeans. Okay? For Kennedy, the resistance on the part of the Europeans, intolerable. And he says, this is one extraordinary document you see it in the archives, your eyes pop out. Kennedy said, they're either going to have to come along or stay behind, but we're moving ahead. Come along or stay behind. Right? Laying down the law to the Europeans. Very different from the Eisenhower strategy. Eisenhower, he viewed himself as kind of a broker, practically, trying to engineer some sort of consensus among the European allies because, it's like herding dogs. The Germans go in one direction, the British in a totally different direction, French somewhere in between. This is difficult for Eisenhower because he doesn't want to lay down the law to the Europeans because he doesn't want the Americans to play that central role. Kennedy, totally different, right? So the notion is that under Kennedy is that the U.S. has to take charge of the policy of the West, both in terms of trying to negotiate with the Soviets and also managing the Western side of the process that could lead to a war. Okay? Kennedy policy. That's in the political sphere. On the military side, they take all sorts of measures that point in the same direction, in the direction of the centralization of control in the hands of the U.S. leadership in Washington. The Americans want to have full control over the policy of the West in dealing with the Soviets, both in terms of peacemaking and in terms of what the West should do if push comes to shove and there's a serious crisis that could lead to war. Okay? And they also want to take measures that would provide the basis for the sort of understanding that they intend to reach with the Soviets, especially measures in the nuclear sphere, right? Under Eisenhower, like I said, by 1960, the European allies had effective control over American nuclear weapons. I got to tell you, I mean, this stuff is pretty extraordinary. This is not just the British, the French, and the Germans. This is all of them. Even the Greeks, well, all of them that took these forces. Even the Greeks and the Turks, and one of the, who are members of NATO by this point, one of the fears in the Kennedy administration is that Greece and Turkey, who are odds with each other, even though they are both allies of the United States, might use nuclear weapons in a war with each other, might use these American nuclear weapons. That's all incidental. The basic problem for the Kennedy people is, if you're serious about, you know, having a deal, one of whose key elements is Germany is not going to be armed with nuclear weapons, you have to withdraw from the nuclear sharing arrangements of the Eisenhower period. And they adopt a whole series of measures as soon as they come to power in 1961 to achieve that goal. And they're, I listed all these acronyms. First, this C-cubed, that means command, control, and communications. A great tightening up of command and control arrangements so that the military authorities can't use nuclear weapons without the okay coming from the political leadership in Washington, simply because they're cut off from communicating with the authorities in the national capital. Right? You want to kind of pull in the reins and prevent the military authorities from being able to order the use of nuclear weapons on their own. To make that possible, to make it certain that unauthorized use of nuclear weapons, these American nuclear weapons, was out of the question, they decided to introduce something called the PALs, P-A-L, permissive action links. These are kind of locks on the nuclear weapons, and you needed to put in a code in order to make them usable. And the code would only come when the okay was given by the National Command Authority in Washington, basically the president or wherever his successor was. This is only for the U.S. forces based in Europe and for the European allies that had access to these American nuclear weapons. It did not apply to the nuclear weapons at sea or controlled by the Strategic Air Command. You want to tighten up in Europe. You have to do it with the Americans, not just with the Europeans, because you wanted to give them the sense that you were not discriminating against them to the extent possible. Okay? SACUR, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. At this point, General Norstedt. You recall how SACUR, during the Eisenhower period, had pre-delegated authority to order the initial use of nuclear weapons. In other words, he didn't have to receive the okay from Washington. There are these delegation letters that were issued during the Eisenhower period. Kennedy, that's the end of pre-delegation. Big conflict between Kennedy administration and General Norstedt, leading, in effect, to the firing of General Norstedt in 1962. Norstedt didn't like any of this stuff, resisted it, but the Kennedy administration was determined, and again, this is military jargon, to rack back, they used the term, to rack back SACUR to the level of a normal American field commander. The clipping of the wings of SACUR was another way it was put at the time. SACUR could not have this extraordinary war-making power that he had under Eisenhower. Right. He couldn't do anything without first getting the green light from Washington. MRBMs, medium-range ballistic missiles. plan during the late Eisenhower period was to deploy American missiles on the territory of the European allies, the continental allies in Europe. Weapons that were capable of destroying targets within the USSR itself, right? The idea was that the earlier means of delivering American nuclear weapons to Europe, fighter bombers and so on, they weren't so good anymore because Soviet air defenses were improving, so you needed ballistic missiles that the Soviets couldn't shoot down. And General Norstad was a big believer in this. The European allies wanted these weapons deployed on their territory. Would they have had a deterrent effect? Well, the basic Kennedy philosophy would have suggested yes, they would have a deterrent effect. You deploy weapons on a chunk of territory, and the mere fact that those weapons are located there rather than elsewhere would tend to deter an adversary from invading that territory. This is, Kennedy says this in a number of different contexts. But those sorts of considerations were not decisive, and instead another set of considerations came into play, which led to the change of policy on the MRBMs. The fear was, if you deploy these missiles on the territory of an ally, that ally would be able to seize control of those missiles in the event of a crisis and have a de facto a strategic nuclear capability. You didn't want that. So no nuclear weapons on the continent of Europe, no land-based weapons. And instead, they had this plan for what was called the MLF. There shouldn't be an S here, but just the MLF. MLF means multilateral force. And the whole idea of the multilateral force had been developed at the end of the Eisenhower administration. And the idea was to get the Europeans to kind of come together and have a nuclear force ultimately under their own control, that is to say, not subject to an American veto. And this force would be deployed at sea, either on surface vessels or on submarines, but it would be a sea-based force, not a land-based force, under not the control of any single, no single weapon would be under control of any single ally, but the allies would be all in this together. The Kennedy administration seized on the MLF and changed its meaning entirely. Now, yeah, the MLF was put forward to the Europeans as a possible option, as a substitute for the MRBMs, but the MLF, would be the use of the forces there would be subject to the American veto, so the Europeans wouldn't be getting anything. And Kennedy thought that this was ludicrous, but he kind of went along with it anyway, because in his first couple of years in office, he was unwilling to defy the established opinion within his government on these issues. So the Americans are pushing the MLF. British and French nuclear weapons. Again, a major change. Now, the Americans turn against the idea of helping the European allies develop nuclear forces under their own control. Turn against the idea of helping the French. As a matter of fact, try and get the French to not build nuclear forces. Even turning against helping the British, who had a nuclear force of their own, had it for some time. The French were just beginning to build theirs. The first nuclear explosion was in 1960. Okay? But the goal of the Kennedy administration, again, and this is in the phrase of the day, was to get the British out of the nuclear business. Get the British out of the nuclear business. Right? To oppose this and to kind of get all the Europeans to rely on the United States for their protection. And why was this? No one really cared about British or French nuclear weapons in and of themselves. I mean, no one in the American government and the Soviet government, that was not the problem. If it would stop there, you could live with British and French nuclear force. It wouldn't make a difference too much one way or the other. As a matter of fact, it might even have a certain positive roles to play. The problem was Germany. Because you couldn't say yes to the British and then say no to the French. But if you said yes to the French, how could you say no to the Germans? But if you said the Germans would deeply resent that sort of discrimination. Oh yeah, we're going to help Britain and France, but not you, because we don't trust you. They're poisoning the alliance. So the idea was, if you want your policy to be viable, the policy of say no to Germany to be viable, then you also have to say no to the French and therefore to the British. Because so American policy moves in that direction. Nuclear doctrine. There's a big myth about the shift in nuclear doctrine from Eisenhower to Kennedy. You read in all the textbooks that Eisenhower had this policy of massive retaliation. The whole idea is they stop a few of our jeeps on the Autobahn into Berlin, and then the balloon goes up, it's World War III. And they execute the PSYOP. Under Kennedy, they shifted to the doctrine of flexible response. Oh no, we're going to move away from reliance on nuclear weapons. We're going to first have much greater emphasis on a conventional capability and fight a conventional war. We want to have more options than just surrender or Holocaust. That's the standard line that people take. When you start looking at these issues more closely, it turns out that those claims are vastly overdrawn. For one thing, the end of the Eisenhower administration, 1960, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, openly used the term flexibility of response as one of their goals. And they wanted to have significant conventional forces, general purpose forces, they call them. You could see this in the planning for dealing with the Berlin crisis. It's not just, if Berlin is cut off and the Soviets stop a couple of jeeps from going down the Autobahn in the city, the plan was not to, use that as the trigger for a general nuclear war. No, it's a policy of gradual escalation. If a platoon were cut off, you'd go up to the level of a battalion, and you keep escalating up to the level of a full division, a full reinforced division, a sizable force. And if the enemy shot at that force, then you would escalate to the use of nuclear weapons. Under Kennedy, it was essentially the same policy, a policy of gradual escalation. They would go to the level of a full army corps, which is to say three divisions, before they went nuclear. But it's essentially the same policy, a little more gradual, a little slower, but still gradual escalation. And both Eisenhower and Kennedy had the whole notion they wouldn't even need conventional forces at all if it were not for the particular problem of Berlin. If it was simply a problem of defending Western Europe, a Western Europe, with NATO forces there, armed to the teeth with nuclear weapons, would be plenty to deter the other side. Both of them took that same line. Yeah? It's World War III, with the little footnote that under the Kennedy administration, they considered an alternate plan to the basic plan for massive all-out use. And the alternate plan was capitalized on the fact that the Soviet forces were still quite vulnerable to an American attack. If you sent the bombers in like really low under the Soviet radar screen, and they targeted only a handful of specific targets, Soviet missile and bomber bases. They knew where these things were. The satellites had gone up in around 1960 with very good ability to kind of identify precise targets. Then you could wipe out the other side essentially without having to, you know, opt for the all-out strike. But basically, it was the same general general thrust. Okay, so they had all this rhetoric about flexible response at the nuclear level. It was called controlled response. And the controlled response was, instead of sending out all of our forces at the outset of the war to destroy as much of the enemy as we possibly could, we would fight the war in a more discriminate way. We would avoid targeting their cities so that the cities would remain intact for their hostage value. As long as we didn't attack their cities, they would have a very strong interest in not destroying our cities, no matter what we did to them. Instead, our attack would be focused on their strategic forces. And if we could wipe out, 80, 90% of their strategic forces, they wouldn't retaliate with, say, the 10 or 20% that they had left, because that would provoke our counter-retaliation against their cities. Right? So that was the official strategy, you know, laid out by Secretary of Defense McNamara in an official NATO meeting in Athens in spring of 1962, you know, laid out in public a couple of months after that. The thing is that's formal strategy, declaratory strategy, didn't correspond to anything in terms of operational planning. We know this now. These were words. It didn't correspond to the basic thinking of people like McNamara and Kennedy. They didn't believe in the notion of controlled and discriminate general nuclear war. They thought that once a nuclear war broke out, you couldn't control it anymore. The argument was laid out for effect. It had an instrumental purpose. And what was the instrumental purpose? The purpose was to dissuade the Europeans from demanding control over their own nuclear forces, for convincing them of the importance of centralized control. Because if you were going to fight a war in that way, you couldn't have just everyone going off on their own with their various different strategies. You needed everyone to have to pursue the same strategy, the American strategy, the supposed strategy of protracted, controlled, discriminate general nuclear war. Not taken seriously by the Americans internally, but was an effective stick with which to beat the Europeans over the head with and dissuade them from going their way. Okay? Well, you can see how all these things fall into a pattern. And the Europeans aren't going to like this. They don't like either aspect of it. The fact that the Americans are insisting on calling all the shots politically, even if it means, you know, taking pursuing policies that are totally at variance with, you know, the basic principles on which German policy had been built. Okay? And they don't like the idea of the Americans concentrating all the military power in their hands and trying to say to all the Europeans, trust us. Don't have nuclear forces of your own. You can trust us. The Europeans felt like, well, America's well-intentioned, but the United States has its own interests, which are not necessarily the same as ours. You know, basically, the Americans were infantilizing the Europeans. They were trying to. So this leads to this big crisis in the Atlantic Alliance, the most serious crisis until the crisis of 2003, in fact. It's like, people are always talking about the crisis in the alliance, the disarray within NATO, and so on. But this time, it was quite serious. And it's not just the Germans are totally alienated, but the French, kind of, for the reasons I discussed before, kind of throwing their lot with the Germans. Even the British, most moderate of the European allies. British are concerned by how fast the Americans are going, by the unilateral aspect of American policy, just laying down the law to the Europeans. And the fact that the Germans have certainly French support means that they could stand up to the Americans better. Standing up to the Americans would not be viewed as nationalistic or anything. It would be viewed as European, because it was France supporting Germany. So you have this sharp crisis, you know, the a very public crisis in 1961-62. Okay. What happens? What's the basic story? After Kennedy meets Khrushchev in Vienna in June of 61, he comes back to the United States utterly appalled by Khrushchev's intransigence. Here, we're trying to be businesslike. We respect their interests. We want to work out some sort of understanding, one great power to the other. And the Soviets just don't want to hear it. You know, they lay down another ultimatum about this whole Berlin business having to be settled by the end of the year. And if not, it would mean war. We are going to liquidate your rights and so on. Kennedy, totally puzzled by this. But he's like, we have no choice. We have to prepare for a showdown. The United States still has the upper hand militarily. Gives this big speech to the country in July. Country has to get ready for war. People are building fallout shelters in their basements and so on. And Khrushchev is amazed at the American reaction. The Americans are actually seriously contemplating war. So Khrushchev, you know, beats a hasty retreat. What does he do? He authorizes the construction of the Berlin Wall in August. Berlin Wall, if you want something that symbolizes Soviet acceptance of the status quo, divided Berlin, a divided Germany, a divided Europe, what better symbol can you ask for than a wall that separates the two parts of Berlin? But the construction of the Berlin Wall was not viewed by the U.S. leadership as the Soviets essentially throwing in the towel on their threat to liquidate the rights of the Western powers in West Berlin. It's like, this is a unilateral act. They did this all by themselves. It foreshadows, you know, further acts of aggression. You know, it vastly increases the risk of war. I think there's a basic, you know, misperception, miscalculation on the part of these people, but it led to this hastening of their policy of trying to reach a negotiated settlement with the Russians, laying out all these concessions, leaking all this stuff to the public and so on. Okay. But the Soviets don't respond the way the Kennedy people had hoped. In fact, all the stuff, I'm certain of this, must have been taken by the Soviets as evidence of American weakness. The Americans are so scared of war that they're going to keep making these concessions. And if the concessions that the Soviets have gotten already are rooted in the American fear of war, well, keep that fear going. You know, give the tree a few more shakes and see what sort of apples fall out. So the Soviets aren't interested in responding to these American overtures. You look at the records of the meetings between the two countries. The Americans come up in March of 1962 with a very important document called the Principles Document, presented to the Soviets, outlining the basic settlement, status quo in Berlin, Soviets accept the Western presence in West Berlin, so on. In exchange for that, we're going to keep West Germany non-nuclear. You know, everyone accepts the status quo. Soviets pocket the U.S. concessions, but don't give anything in exchange. And this is what leads to this very fundamental shift in American policy in the middle of 1962, the summer of 1960. We have our problems with the Europeans. Our policy of trying to reach an understanding with the Soviets has been poisoning our relations with the Europeans, and the Soviets aren't reciprocating. Well, if we can get a deal with the Russians, the Europeans could be made to accept it. The arrangements, the negotiations with the Soviets are therefore crucial, but they're not giving us anything. We're willing to give them everything that they have a legitimate right to, maybe even a little bit more than that. We understand their kind of core interests, but they're unwilling to reach a deal on that basis. Right? And what this means for Kennedy and his top associates is that if a showdown is inevitable, and looks increasingly like a showdown is inevitable, then it's much better to have it sooner rather than later. And why is this the case? Because everyone knows that the era of American nuclear superiority is coming to an end. The Soviets are finally in the process of constructing survivable forces. And in fact, it's only in September of 1963 that the president is briefed that the era of American superiority is over. We cannot contemplate a first strike under any circumstances. Preemption is out of the question. They see this coming on the horizon. It's coming just a few months away. And for Kennedy, what this means, and this is how you can see the kind of the window dynamic coming into play. Kennedy's whole notion is, if we have to have it out with these people, let it be sooner rather than later. That's the context for the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Cuban Missile Crisis isn't just something that happens outside of this whole story. The Cuban Missile Crisis is the climax of this whole affair. You know, part of the reason why the Americans make such a big deal over the deployment of the Soviet missiles in Cuba is that this is an occasion for settling accounts with these people, for having it out, finally, for bringing all these issues to a head while we still have the nuclear age. Cuban Missile Crisis, climax of the whole Berlin Crisis business. Because, among other things, when the United States government was contemplating what to do when it was discovered that Soviet missiles were in Cuba, it had to worry about possible Soviet retaliation to whatever the Americans did vis-a-vis Cuba with the countermeasures the Soviets could take around Berlin. So the Berlin business is connected with it in that sense. And it's also connected with it in terms of people trying to understand, why is it that the Soviets are deploying these missiles in Cuba? Well, they want to strengthen themselves strategically for this showdown with the Americans over Berlin that they had threatened repeatedly. They actually, they would tell President Kennedy, well, we understand your domestic political needs, that you have this election coming up in November of 62. We're not going to do anything until the election is over, and then we'll push you in Berlin. You know, the Americans sensed the connection here with the Berlin issue. All right, so just very quickly, you know the basic story of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Americans discover the missiles. They try and figure out what to do. They rapidly reach the conclusion that the presence of those missiles there in Cuba is simply unacceptable. And they demand the withdrawal of those missiles. They institute certain military measures, most notably the blockade of Cuba, but also the putting of the Strategic Air Command on a very high level of alert that underscore the intent, these measures underscore the intensity with which the American government regards this particular issue. Okay? And the Soviets give away. Not to an American ultimatum, pure and simple, because the Americans make certain concessions of their own, although disguised concessions, relating to the withdrawal of the Jupiter missiles from Turkey, kept from the public and framed to the Soviets in a false light. But still, it's not the Soviets simply capitulating before an American ultimatum. The story is more complex than that. But the fact is, the Soviets gave way to this American pressure. And the effect of all of this was to clear the air, a la Blaney, you know, that the crises have an important political function. They reveal what the true balance of power is, including the balance of resolve. And it's in the light of what's revealed by the crisis that countries then enter into negotiations towards further political relations. And we'll see next time how events develop between the Americans and the Soviets and how the elements of a stable international order fall into place in the post-Cuban Missile Crisis period, and especially in the year 1963. Okay? So that's it for today.